This question was submitted for our study this quarter. It's an appropriate question, and it's particularly appropriate in view of the fact we have people in the congregation who carry weapons and are policemen, and some have family members who are soldiers or have been soldiers. So let's turn to the Word of God and see some things that we can learn by looking at some passages along this line. We begin with Exodus chapter 20 and verse 13. This may be the reason why this has become such a controversial subject. In the King James Version, it is translated, "You shall not kill." There's nothing wrong with that translation, but it may be broader than what God intended in its connotation. In the New American Standard Version and in the New King James Version, it's translated, "You shall not commit murder." And so the question is raised, are they doing us a favor by translating it, instead of "you shall not kill," "you shall not commit murder"? Does the Bible make a difference in killing, in that some killing is legitimate and some killing is murder? In Genesis chapter 9, verse 5 and 6, Genesis 9, verse 5 and 6. But Noah came out of the ark. Here is a law that was put in place. This is before the Jewish dispensation. It was a patriarchal law. So far as I know, that law was applicable to all men, still is applicable. And so the verse says, "Surely I'll require your lifeblood. From every beast I will require it, and from every man, from every man's brother, I will require the life of man. Whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed, for in the image of God he made man." Now when you read that at first, you may say that is an absolute law that prohibits killing. But does it? What is required by this divine law? If a person kills another person, what this law requires is that that person be put to death or killed. This very law against killing commands killing. Now, who is to do the killing? If somebody has killed their fellow man, who is to take the life blood from the one who did the killing? The text says, by man his blood shall be shed. So it's not an act of God that he does something directly from heaven, but here God authorizes men to kill men. This is by divine law and appointment in cases where there has been unauthorized killing. So clearly this passage shows, does it not, that all killing is not sinful. And all killing is not forbidden by Exodus chapter 20 and verse 13. That has to be clear by looking at Genesis 9, 6. If you look up the definition of the word murder, I've got three definitions here. You'll find the same thing, I think, if you look in a dictionary similar to what I have here. Here's one definition from Oxford Dictionary: the unlawful premeditated killing of one human being by another. Here's another definition from the American Heritage Dictionary. The unlawful killing of one human being by another, especially with premeditated malice. And then Webster's New World Dictionary, the unlawful and malicious or premeditated killing of one human being by another. So you can see that murder is defined in our dictionary, and all that a dictionary is doing is telling how we use a word involves the fact that it's an unlawful killing, and that there's an attitude, a personal attitude involved of either hatred or contempt or revenge or something of that nature, malicious intent. We'll see as we continue to study that the Bible makes a difference in killing someone with that attitude and killing someone accidentally or killing someone by divine appointment. So we have the question on the sheet. Is the person who carries out this law in Genesis 9:6? He says, by man his blood shall be shed. This particular law doesn't give us details about civil government, but when we read the rest of scriptures, we know that that is the case. But even before then, as we'll see when we look at Deuteronomy and Numbers, God appointed what was called an avenger of blood, a relative who was to right the wrong by killing the murderer. And so that person who did that obviously is doing something that's lawful and not guilty of murder, because it's not unlawful and it's not a matter of personal vengeance. Now there's a reason given here in verse 6 why a man is prohibited from murdering. The reason given is, for in the image of God he made man. That he has respect for the dignity of human life. When killing disregards the dignity of human life, man made in the image of God. That's one of the factors in murder. People murder, they have no regard for their fellow man, taking their life, that they're made in the image of God. And that is a deed for which God said there should be capital punishment. Exodus chapter 21. Turn to Exodus chapter 21, if you will. Very interesting in the fact that these verses we're looking at are next to one another. We have verse 15 and 16, but then under part C of this question, we have verse 12 through 14. So let's look at, first of all, verse 15 and 16. Who strikes his father or his mother shall surely be put to death. He who kidnaps a man, whether he sells him or he's found in his possession, shall surely be put to death. He who curses his father or his mother shall surely be put to death. We're aware of the fact that this law and this nation, it was not only religious but civil. And God empowered their rulers or judges to enact these penalties. We'll see more about that in just a moment. And so here's the law that people who are guilty of the three things that are stated in 15, 16, and 17, either one of the three, the penalty is capital punishment, as we call it. In other words, death. I have under part B of your lesson, 3B, additional examples. We'll not read all those verses. But in all of those verses, there's a consistency in that capital punishment is demanded for these offenses. Sorcery, idolatry, violation of the Sabbath, adultery, incest, bestiality, and blasphemy of God. And so it was common, it was not an exception, that under the Jewish dispensation and the law given by God, that men were to be killed or put to death by divine appointment. and men were to exact that penalty. So somebody was authorized by God to kill their fellow man when they had unlawfully either taken the life of someone else or was involved in these other acts contrary to God's law for that nation. But if you back up to verse 12 through 14 in this same text, he who strikes a man so that he dies shall surely be put to death. But if he did not lie in wait for him, but God let him fall into his hand, then I will appoint you a place to which he may flee. If, however, a man acts presumptuously toward his neighbor, so as to kill him craftily. So presumptuously, there's will involved, there's purpose involved. It's not an accident. We talk about premeditated. He acts presumptuously toward his neighbor so as to kill him craftily. You are to take him even from my altar that he may die. In other words, there is no refuge. There's not to be any excuse for the exacting the penalty of death in that case. So here in verse 15, 16, and 17, you have the law of capital punishment for these three things mentioned. But back in verse 12, we're told that if you strike a man to put him to death, then you're to be put to death. Wait a minute. Here's a guy who's a kidnapper. So I read this law, he's to be put to death. So I and some others get some stones and we start striking this man with stones until he dies. Well, verse 12 says, he strikes a man so that he dies shall surely be put to death. It's clear, is it not, that the putting to death in verse 12 is not the same as murder. It's clear there's a different kind of killing involved. The first part of verse 12 is murder, and that man is to be put to death, to be killed, but that's not murder. These three sins that are listed in 15, 16, and 17, man's to be put to death, but that's not murder. And so he makes a distinction, however, in verse 13, where if there is no premeditation, there is no purpose, there is no plan. It's not a matter of disregard for the law of God or disregard for human life. It happens. Now, in that particular case, there's a different law in place. And God appointed what was called cities of refuge. We'll read more about that in a minute, where such a person could flee. And they would need to flee because their relative could be, had authority to be, an avenger of blood. So they went to the city of refuge. There were six cities set apart. And there the elders were to pass judgment on the case. And if it was determined that the man was not a premeditated murderer, they were to give him shelter. But if it was decided by the elders of that city that he was guilty of premeditated murder, we'll see in just a moment, they were to hand him over to the avenger of blood. Clearly in this law, we'll see a difference in the kind of killing that was done. If you have some comments, feel free to raise your hand as we go through this material. We're simply turning to scriptures, trying to reason from those scriptures some things that we can learn. The three chapters that I have on number four have to do with the cities of refuge. Obviously, we don't have time in our class to read the entirety of those chapters. But start with me in Deuteronomy. So now the people are preparing to go into the promised land, and Moses preaches this sermon and sets in order these laws as they enter into the land that God prepared for them. And every law that God made is for the good of mankind. It may sound strange that the law to kill your fellow man can be for the good of mankind, but it is. Now, in Deuteronomy 19, we'll start in verse 11. If there is a man who hates his neighbor, remember we talked about malice? There is a man who hates his neighbor and lies in wait for him. Remember we talked about premeditated, purposeful, presumptuous. Lies in wait for him and rises up against him and strikes him so that he dies. I remember we read in Exodus 21 about a case where that wasn't the case. It was an accident. He didn't do that. That's the case that's being described here. So he flees to one of these cities of refuge. Then the elders of his city shall send and take him from there and deliver him into the hand of the avenger of blood that he may die. Are the elders guilty of murder? Are they? Should they also be prosecuted as associates in this man dying? Certainly not. They're doing what God said. In fact, if you'll note the next verse, it would be wrong for them not to do that. God didn't give them the option. You shall not pity him. We have a lot of talk about love and compassion. What happens when we read the Bible if we're not careful? We don't end up with a view of the character of God or his people. We end up with a caricature. You go down to the Six Flags or to a state fair, there's a guy drawing, and he'll draw a caricature of you. And so he'll look at you, and maybe he'll draw something that looks like you, but then he'll make you have big ears or a big nose or something like that. In other words, he will overemphasize some feature of you. That's what you have when you picture a God, the God of the Bible, that he's just love. That's all. He's just love. There's no hatred of sin. There's no penalty of judgment. That's not the character of God. That's a caricature. And people talk about Christians ought to love, and they'll refer to 1 Corinthians 13, and that's correct. But a Christian who cannot hate sin, and even a Christian who's to be long-suffering, there is a limit to that. To picture a Christian as he's just compassionate and loving, and he can have no desire for being avenged for his wrong. That's not the character of a Christian. That is a caricature of what a Christian is. And so you can clearly see here, no pity. No pity for a man who was guilty of this. Look at Numbers chapter 35. This is a very interesting statement here that we find. He's talking about, verse 22, He pushed him suddenly without enmity. We talked about that malice thing. There's no malice. There's no premeditation. Or threw something at him without lying in wait. In other words, it wasn't an intent to murder out of vengeance or hatred or malice. But he died. And so, verse 24, the congregation shall judge between the slayer and the blood avenger according to these ordinances. The congregation shall deliver the man's slayer from the hand of the blood avenger, and the congregation shall restore him to his city of refuge to which he fled. So there's a judgment to be rendered whether or not this is really the case. And he shall live in it until the death of the high priest who was anointed with the holy oil. But if the man's slayer at any time goes beyond the border of his city of refuge to which he may flee, and the blood avenger finds him outside the border of his city of refuge, and the blood avenger kills the manslayer. Look at that last statement. He will not be guilty of blood. We've pointed out time and again that blood is used in the Bible oftentimes for death. He'll not be guilty of murder. While the man did not engage in premeditated murder, he did take another man's life, maybe through carelessness, and there will be consequences the rest of his life, or at least until the high priest dies. And if he does not observe these laws, he exposes himself to being punished by the avenger of blood. Verse 28. Because he should have remained in his city of refuge until the death of the high priest. So clearly here's a case where one man can avenge the blood of his relative under God's laws and for God's purposes without being guilty of murder. That's not the same as, I hate you, you killed my relative, I'm going to go kill you. That's not the same thing. So you can clearly see that we've got to be careful when we read Exodus chapter 20 and verse 12, you shall not kill, that we don't make that a blanket statement that condemns peace officers, soldiers, the fellow who turns on the gas in the gas chamber, the fellow who pulls the switch on the electric chair. Exodus 20 and 12 does not necessarily condemn that guy. Now, if that guy on the electric chair or in the gas chamber had done something to his family, it may be more difficult for that person to do that without personal vengeance and malice. That may be difficult. But the act itself is not murder. Observe some things we've seen from these verses. The blood avenger was not guilty of murder. The witnesses and society who stoned the guilty were not guilty of murder. Remember Achan, who took the forbidden treasure and the people stoned him and his family to death? The man who killed accidentally was not guilty of murder. And so based on these considerations, we know the answer to this question. All killing is not murder. There are other facets that go into what we call murder and what is forbidden in Exodus chapter 20 and verse 12. Well, one of the passages that's often considered is Matthew 5. When I was a young man growing up, for a while at least, I was under the conception that you could never kill, even to defend your family. I think I was wrong. But one of the passages that I heard and heard preached, it was Matthew 5:38-42. So let's read that. You have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you, do not resist an evil person, but whoever slaps you on your right cheek, turn the other to him also. If anyone wants to sue you and take your shirt, let him have your coat also. Whoever forces you to go 1 mile, go with him 2. give to him who asks of you, and do not turn away from him who wants to borrow from you. If you read these verses that I have on the sheet, which maybe we'll have time, but I don't know if we will. If you were to read those verses in Exodus 21 and Leviticus 24 and Deuteronomy 19, you will see that these were laws that were given to regulate the judges in the penalty they meted out. The penalty was to accord with the crime. An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. It was never, ever meant, even under Old Testament law, to say, you smack me in the mouth, I'm going to smack you. You black my eye, I'm going to black both of yours. Never meant to justify that. Wasn't under the Old Testament even. And so here are their religious teachers teaching in the synagogue. And they show that the law forbade murder. No question about that. But then they took this, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, and justified personal vengeance. Never was it intended to do that. And so Jesus talks about the attitude of one who's going to be a citizen of the kingdom of heaven. He can't have that attitude of personal vengeance. Back in these verses in the Old Testament, in Exodus 21:22, I will turn to one of them. If men struggle with each other and strike a woman with child so that she gives birth prematurely, yet there's no injury, he shall surely be fined as the woman's husband may demand of him, and he shall pay as the judges decide. But if there's any further injury, you shall appoint as a penalty. Note, now here's what the judges do. Life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, bruise for bruise. And it was not left to their personal feelings. They did not even have the option to say, ah, we'll forget it. They didn't have that option. If they were going to be the judges doing the will of God, they had to follow through with penalty fitting the crime. And so this may entail taking a person's life by divine order. It was abused then, it's abused today to justify personal vengeance, but never in the Old Testament or the New was it intended to justify personal vengeance. Just interesting to note, by the way, if it literally means anytime someone slaps you, you turn the other cheek. The Lord didn't. Paul didn't. And if it means somebody wants to use the law against you, that you just say, okay, well, just do whatever you want to me with the law. Paul certainly didn't do that. He said, I appeal to Caesar. And he defended himself at law. And so, if it's taken literally, Jesus didn't fit the mold and Paul didn't fit the mold. So that's something to consider in these verses. So I believe a man can defend his family. I do believe that. Now, if somebody has a different view and wants to state it, raise your hand. We'll let you speak. Okay?
I have a question.
No, no questions. You got to make comments. All right, what's your question?
Where were we? We talked about the cities of refuge. I mean, if the guy goes out of the city of refuge and the blood avenger kills him until the high priest dies, does that mean that everything was wiped clean when the high priest died?
When the high priest died, he did not evidently have to stay in the city of refuge.
But...
And the blood avenger would not have the right then to kill him, evidently. Why until the high priest died? I do not know.
You're supposed to know the answer to these things.
I do not know. Rod, Wally, do y'all know the answer? They don't know either, so you're out of luck. When you read these passages about the Avenger of Blood, there's three chapters I gave there. Deuteronomy 19, Numbers 35, and Joshua 20. Let's just take one of them. We'll start with Numbers 35. Okay, look at verse 16 of Numbers 35. But if he struck him down with an iron object so that he died, he is a murderer. The murderer shall surely be put to death. Verse 17, shall surely be put to death. Verse 18, shall surely be put to death. Verse 19, the blood avenger himself shall put the murderer to death. He shall put him to death when he meets him. I do not know that he had an option. Okay, anybody see anything different about that? Yes. Genesis 9. Footnote. Okay, the point has been made in Genesis 9:5. First it says from every man, then it says every man's brother. And that may allude to this very thing. No, I had not picked up on that. That's interesting. That may be further explaining. Yes, that's an interesting point. I had not thought about that. It'll be something I can go back and look at. Appreciate you bringing that up. Romans 13. Good questions. Romans chapter 13. Start in verse 1. Every person is to be in subjection to the governing authorities. For there is no authority except from God, and those which exist are established by God. Therefore, everyone or whoever resists authority has opposed the ordinance of God. And they who have opposed will receive condemnation upon themselves. It's a strong passage about respect for civil law. For rulers are not a cause of fear for good behavior, but for evil. By the way, by implication, you see what the purpose of civil government is. Our government has lost that direction, unfortunately. Rulers are not a cause for fear for good behavior, but for evil. Do you want to have no fear of authority? Do what is good, and you will have praise from the same. For it is a minister of God. We talk about ministers. Sometimes churches put on the sign, the minister. Would you think of a police officer as a minister of God? A judge in a court? That's the way this passage is talking, isn't it? He's a minister of God to you for good. But if you do what is evil, be afraid, for it does not bear the sword for nothing. for it is a minister of God, an avenger who brings wrath on the one who practices evil. Whose wrath? God's wrath. God's wrath. Therefore, it is necessary to be in subjection not only because of wrath, but also for conscience sake, etc. So, we note here who is the minister of God to carry out his will. So he talks about the rulers, verse 3, the rulers, and it would be the rulers and their agents. Rulers don't get out personally and carry weapons and arrest prisoners and put them in jail and bring them to death, but they are authorized and have appointed agents to carry that out. And so, the rulers are their agents acting under the authority divinely delegated civil government. So we ask the question on the lesson, thee, is the sword literal? We don't use swords today, and even then, that it meant that he had to use a literal sword. Could he have used a javelin or some other weapon to either constrain obedience to law or to prevent harming the fellow man or bringing death? If my understanding is that sword is not literal, but stands for whatever implement or whatever method or whatever agent would be used to execute civil justice, and it may include death, and that's the word sword. And he says, be afraid, he does not exercise or carry the sword in vain. Does not bear the sword for nothing. It's not for show. It's to be used by God's appointment. We could maybe substitute the idea of a pistol, for example. He does not bear the pistol for nothing. So, here is a way that God's wrath is to be executed through civil government. They're really serving God in doing this. And so when they do that, when that ruler renders a judgment against someone who's harmed their fellow man, that he is to be imprisoned or he is to be put to death, is he guilty of murder? Obviously not. It's obviously not. Do you have a comment, John?
Well, I've always looked at, when somebody asked me this question, you know, my son went in the Marines, and he's a policeman now, but I've always thought Luke chapter 3, and I didn't see it on your notes, where John the Baptist is going about preaching the message of the kingdom. And, you know, he's talking about the tree bearing bad fruit, ready to be cut down, thrown in the fire, and all that stuff. And then people are coming to him, what shall we do? And then he talks about the tax collectors, the first group to come to him, or well, the second, I guess, the group as a whole first. But then the second one is the soldiers in verse 15 come to him. And, you know, and their question is, what shall we do? You know? And he said to them, do not take any money from anyone by force. So that's saying, do your job. Just don't do that. He says, or accuse anyone falsely. So do your job, don't do that. And the last thing, be content with your wages. And that definitely tells me to do your job. And so here's the messenger of the kingdom telling them to do your job. If there was ever a time for somebody to say, drop down your weapon, the kingdom is not about that, it would have been right there. Although he was Christ, but he was still preaching the message of the kingdom.
That's a good point. He was preaching a message of repentance. The change of will against sin. Certainly, if that would have been a sinful thing for these men to be soldiers, it looks like when they ask, what shall we do, that he would have told them, you need to change professions. Yes, David?
I have a side question. What about in this scripture we're studying, what if we're back in the 1700s, and it's the British are coming in, and I want to be part of that American Revolution? Would this be speaking against that because I'm going against the British government at that time?
David's question is, it's back in the 1700s and the British are coming in, and so can you join forces against the British government? Same thing would be true in the Civil War, same kind of question. It's a very good question. I don't know that I could, David. Not everybody's going to answer that the same way. Obviously, we're glad for the freedom it brought about in both cases, but I don't know that I could. Somebody else want to weigh in on that? I don't know that we're, you know, the Roman government wasn't always good, but there was never an encouragement or allowance that I know of for Christians to rebel against Roman government. Now, not everybody's going to agree with that, but that's a good question. And maybe there's something that I haven't considered that would change my mind. Maybe you can help me with that. Right along the lines of what John was talking about, look at Acts chapter 10. I thought John had a good point there in Luke 3. In fact, I've added that to my notes. You have this man named Cornelius. He's a centurion, which originally was over 100 soldiers. Didn't necessarily strictly mean that later, but he was a soldier in command with the Italian cohort. What's interesting, and we asked the second question, what kind of man was he before he became a Christian? And so you think of a soldier maybe as a rough character with no morals, but that's not this man. He was a devout man, one who feared God with all his household, gave many alms to the Jewish people, and prayed to God continually. But as a centurion, would he enforce the law? Would he carry out his role as a soldier? Obviously. That is not necessarily in contrast to being a devout man who fears God and loves people. And we maybe want to put those as if you can't have both, but here's a man who exhibited both. There's no indication in the text that either his profession or his character changed after he became a Christian. What he needed was forgiveness of his sins, and Christ provided that. Okay, our time about up. Look at the last question for thought discussion. Can a soldier, police officer, or someone else authorized to carry a weapon misuse that privilege? And I simply said yes, due to personal vengeance, corruption, carelessness, and human mistake. We see that in the news at times, where those in positions of authority use their authority, whether soldiers or policemen, in abusive ways. But does the potential of these abuses invalidate the right and need of these of policemen and soldiers? I have some examples. Currency, money. Is money ever abused? Certainly. Is it used to oppress? Yes. Is there counterfeit money? Yes. So should we do away with currency? Are automobiles abused? Do people have auto wrecks and kill and maim people? Yes. Yes, they do. Should we do away with automobiles? No. Parents, do they hurt their children in supposed discipline? Yes. So should we take away the right of parents to discipline children? No. So the abuses that may occur doesn't take away the fact that men are authorized to enforce the law and serve as soldiers in our government. Thank you for your